Good afternoon. You're listening to KTOO. I'm Yvonne Crumery. Thank you for tuning in. The Juno Assembly is set to take a critical vote Monday night that will determine if the construction of a fifth cruise ship dock downtown will move forward. The development proposal is from Huna Totem Corporation, an Alaska Native Village corporation that has been trying to build the dock and waterfront development for years. The Assembly's vote is about whether or not to lease city-owned tidelands, the submerged land in the channel. Without a tidelands lease, the dock project can't move forward. Huna Totem has proposed building the dock along Egan Drive near Juneau's U.S. Coast Guard Station and across the street from KTOO. It would be paired with a waterfront development called Auk Landing, which would include things like underground parking, retail space, and a culture and science center. Huna Totem says the new dock will help disperse visitors and reduce downtown congestion. Critics of the project don't buy that, though, and say they're concerned about the growth of tourism in town and the potential environmental impacts of the dock. Both Huna Totem and the city have held public meetings for residents to learn about the project in recent months. It has also gone through years of city meetings and procedural steps to get to this point. The meeting on Monday starts at 7 p.m. at City Hall. Residents can testify on the topic in person or online before the Assembly takes the vote. And 2 weeks after a rock slide came down over Ketchikan's Tongass Highway, cleanup work is still slowing down traffic on the only road to the north side of the island. In the days after the slide, crews constructed a bypass road for travelers to get around the work area. But that road has repeatedly been reduced to a single lane during daytime hours, often creating miles-long traffic backups. But starting last night, the bypass is now open to two-way traffic. According to the construction company Secon, the road will remain open to two-way traffic until further notice. It's been more than a year since the Juneau Assembly voted to move forward with a plan to demolish the downtown Telephone Hill neighborhood's historic homes and add more than 100 new housing units. But since then, not much movement on the project has happened, which residents living there say has left them in limbo. KTOO's Clarice Larson has more.
Joe Carson rents an apartment on Telephone Hill. He's been living there for 2 decades. Since the city and borough of Juneau took over ownership of the neighborhood's land about 2 years ago, he's been checking his mailbox for an eviction notice. So far, nothing's come.
I don't know if I could be evicted this summer or I could be here forever. I don't know. I have not heard from the city. Nobody has.
The neighborhood is on roughly 4 acres of land on a hill that straddles the state office building downtown. The city took it over from the state in 2023, which had owned it since the 80s. It was originally intended to build a new Capitol complex there, but that obviously never happened. Last year, the Juneau Assembly voted to redevelop the neighborhood to build denser housing there. Members said the decision was in response to Juneau's severe lack of housing. But Carson says that same severe lack of housing is exactly why he and many of his neighbors haven't looked for another place, despite knowing the city's plan.
I don't really have a plan B, to tell you the truth. Given what the housing is, if I wasn't living here, I'm not sure what I would do. Because, I mean, this is not a good time to find yourself without housing in Juneau, that's for sure.
Another Telephone Hill resident, Morgan Duffseth, says she's stressed about finding a new place and also worries that the new units built won't be affordable for most residents.
There's a lot of different things you could do with this other than turn it into condos.
Last year, the city put out a request for interest for developers who might want to take on the project. The deadline to reply was in late February, and only one developer responded. It was a Washington and Idaho-based developer called Johnson & Carr. In its response to the city, the company says it wants to take on the project in spite of significant economic obstacles. It outlined a plan to build, quote, no less than some combination of 40 affordable units for all income groups, modest-priced single-level housing for seniors, and, likely, market-rate for-sale condominiums. Here's Tyler Carr with the company.
It does take collaboration with the city to figure out the different financing vehicles that are available for different depths of affordability. So not to be vague, but that's at this level, it still has to be widely bracketed until we get further collaboration from the city and market analysis.
Last year, the Assembly agreed to set a goal for the project to offer about a fifth of the new units at below market rent. But there are no actual mandated requirements in place yet. Those, if any, are likely to be discussed by the Assembly later down the line. Though some members, like Mayor Beth Weldon, have said they worry that adding additional requirements might discourage developers from doing the project. This is her speaking on the topic this fall.
My personal feeling is we should just let an outright bidding war happen and, get as much money we can from the Telephone Hill. It's prime real estate. We would get prime costs.
City officials have warned that if the assembly wants to mandate affordability requirements as part of the development, they can expect to have to pay for it. According to city manager Katie Kester, the project still has quite a few steps to go before breaking ground.
Telephone Hill will be redeveloped. However, we're, you know, not evicting anyone without having real solid timelines and a plan for what that development looks like. So I know that there's some uncertainty in that.
She says the residents there should be looking for other places to live in the meantime. The assembly will likely get an update on the project in the coming months and decide on how to move forward with redevelopment. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
And the high-priority bill that would substantially boost education funding took another step forward in the legislature this week. The version of House Bill 69 advanced by the Senate Education Committee on Wednesday still includes the $1,000 boost to basic per-student funding approved by the House. But as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, Senate leaders say they haven't settled on whether to reduce the funding boost amid a budget crunch.
It's been a constant chorus for years. Alaska schools are underfunded and struggling to do the very basics of educating the state's kids. The refrain came around the Capitol again just a few days ago.
When I hear education's failing, I say no, education's starving.
That's Lisa Parody. She leads an advocacy group for principals and superintendents called the Alaska Council of School Administrators. She testified at a recent hearing alongside longtime school leaders. Senate Education Committee Chair Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat, says that's why she maintained the House's $1,000 boost in the bill she moved forward.
We recognize that we need to have a substantial increase to school funding to help starve off so many of the devastating impacts that our districts have been communicating to us.
Here's the thing, though. Well, two things. Three tops. First, the state is facing deficits of, to use a technical term, gazillions of dollars. Close to $500 million for the next year is the latest estimate. We have low oil prices largely to thank for that. And Senate budget hawks have been hesitant to pull from the state's rainy day fund to fill the gap. This year alone would wipe out at least a quarter of what lawmakers have socked away. Reducing the permanent fund dividend is another unattractive option. So the $270 million plus price tag of the education bill is, let's say, difficult. But thing two, is it really that much? Tobin says no. Compared to the status quo, it's about a quarter of that. As Republicans have pointed out on numerous occasions, lawmakers and the governor have boosted funding in the past few years. It's just been on a one-time basis. Schools got the equivalent of $680 in basic per-student funding last year. So that's Tobin's case. The funding boost looks a lot smaller when you compare it to the status quo. She's hoping that might be an easier pill for budgeters in the Senate to swallow. But, of course there's another but, thing three. Lawmakers' objective here is not just about finding a funding level that improves education without breaking the bank. It's also about passing a bill Governor Mike Dunleavy will, unlike last year, actually sign rather than veto. He just came out with a new statement on the bill. He says the bill Tobin advanced, quote, doesn't pass muster. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, says he's hoping to meet with the governor soon to talk things out. But in the meantime,
just reading the tea leaves, I think there's probably a good chance the governor would veto $1,000. And if he does that, then where are we?
Stevens says the debate that's been playing out in this story for the past 3 minutes or so is ongoing within the Senate's Democrat-heavy bipartisan majority caucus. He says they haven't settled on an appropriate dollar figure. That question is now in the hands of the Senate Finance Committee. That's the bill's last stop before a full Senate vote. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
And while the Forest Service staffing at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center remains uncertain, there will be 8 people working at the glacier in a different role, as cultural ambassadors. They're employed by the local tribe, and they teach visitors about Tlingit history, culture, and its connections to the land. At the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, cultural ambassadors are learning how to best represent Tlingit stewardship and connections to the glacier to the roughly 1 million tourists slated to visit this summer.
You're with the storytellers.
Sani Liana Wallace sets off down the walkway towards Deep Creek.
We'll never stop talking.
For today's training, her supervisor is sending her and her fellow ambassadors out to study the plants along nearby trails and take photos of the ones they don't know.
Join the crowd! We're talking about plants, so Lee, who's been here a while, is going to show me a plant that he wants us to work on.
They're part of the group of ambassadors who will be at the glacier when tourists start arriving in less than 2 weeks. And with continued uncertainty about Forest Service staffing, the role may take on new significance at the glacier. The Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska program started last year as part of a co-stewardship agreement the tribe formed with the U.S. Forest Service. It will allow people like Shock Dintach, Jonah Johnson, to teach visitors about Devil's Club, or as it's called in Tlingit. Tsocht. Because there's more to it than meets the eye.
It looks like it's just a harmful plant, but it's really our medicine plant.
In February, a wave of federal firings left one remaining Forest Service staff member at the visitor center. In a typical summer, there are about a dozen on site. Some of the fired staff have been rehired, but there are rumors they may lose their jobs again or accept a deferred leave offer. Forest Service officials say they aren't able to share any plans for staffing for the summer. But while that's up in the air, the cultural ambassadors are moving forward with their plan to staff the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. Goosk Ralph Wolf directs Indigenous stewardship programs like the cultural ambassadors at the glacier.
We're still out there. We're still going to be there. And we're just trying to figure out where we can help the Forest Service kind of fill in.
He says he's been thinking of how the ambassadors may be stepping in to do the work the Forest Service rangers would be doing, like managing safety. But he says the program's mission is still focused on highlighting Indigenous stewardship.
We're trying to be flexible while also making sure our missions to make sure that the culture is passed on.
Cultural Ambassador Lee Miller is returning for his second season. He says he thinks all the staff at the glacier will be spread thin this year.
But it's exciting. I mean, every day is different. Every person is different.
Miller says he loves representing the Occoquan and bringing the joy of the natural world to the visitors.
You can pass it on to them. You're coming in and you say, okay, I just saw a porcupine out on the meadow there, or an eagle or a heron, and just point it out to them and they'll ask you questions.
Miller's family has been here for thousands of years, but he'll be greeting people who are seeing the glacier for the first time.
Just interacting with them and watching, that made the whole season.
And the 2025 season begins April 14th, when the first ship arrives. And as for the weather here in Juneau, it's 43 degrees and raining. And it looks like we'll have rain through the weekend, with temperatures in the mid to high 40s. You're listening to KTOO. For more news, go to ktoo.org. Thank you for tuning in.